And hey, we're back on Downtown here on a Wednesday afternoon. Rich Kimble and Bruce Pratt. And it's time for this week's edition of Sports Lit 101. And Bruce, excited to have this conversation because I loved Scott's work that you shared with me on his college baseball days. You want to do the introductions for us this afternoon?
I certainly would. Yes, we have with us Scott Palmieri, professor at Johnson & Wales University, a member of the Sport Literature Association, a great writer of baseball fiction, and a well-published poet. But here we have a piece of nonfiction from the journal known as Sport Literate called Feeds that we want to talk about with Scott. And Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Bruce. Hi, Rich. Thanks so much for having me. Honor and pleasure to be here.
Well, I, of course, first knew your work as the some of the fiction regarding your time in the Wooden Bat Leagues. Great stuff. And someday we're going to have you back someday to talk about The Wrong Jimenez. Which is a great story. But in Feeds, you do something that I think is really important for people to understand. And you played Division I college baseball at Providence College. Right. And that's in New England. That's in the best league that we have in New England, many people would say. Maine might not agree, but that's okay. And you came in as a freshman, and you began playing in the rotation right away with other freshmen. And it wasn't like high school anymore. And if you could just sort of unpack a little bit what that experience was like when you first got there, you know, your expectation, and then boom, look at this.
Absolutely. You know, I actually wrote a shorter piece about the night before my first practice, which was involving a mile that we had to run. And our welcome from the coach was so intense that I ran the mile in about a minute faster than I had ever run in my life. And I knew at that moment, coming off of the track exhausted, that I was in for something I didn't even expect. It was, you know, all of a sudden I'm in like the Squid Game, and getting thrown things that I had never thought I would, and pushing myself physically and mentally more than I ever would. And I knew that in the first 24 hours, and in that first practice, which this story kind of sketches a little bit, in that first fall, it was completely other level of playing, for me, that's why I kind of focused on this experience, because I felt as if that captured college baseball for me. But just that first day, that first couple weeks, the first couple months, and it kind of said everything perhaps I could say about college baseball at that time.
Hope for the best, but know the worst is coming.
Exactly. As wonderful experience as it was, and we were so fortunate to have it, to be able to go to a great school and to come out with a great degree and play great baseball, there was a good healthy amount of time we were fairly miserable. And it was just sort of finding a way to overcome those things and to pull together, and trying not to be too romantic about it, you know, trying to be get into the grid of what it was like day to day. So it wasn't all poignancy, but it was tough. It was tough, and we kind of held together.
As a fellow teacher of literature and creative writing and the like, what I really loved was the line, we're talking about, deep down we knew the worst wasn't real suffering. At least it wasn't the suffering I read about in my English classes. Sylvia Plath's despair, Flannery O'Connor always killing people, and Shakespeare killing more. I mean, I thought about, you're on the bus and at the end, and you're trying to get back to campus in time to eat, and I'm thinking, yes, this is Shakespearean. They could all die.
I mean, exactly.
You know, this is, you know, I don't think a lot of people today who are on a college campus have any idea what it was like. You come at the end of practice, and you line up for slop. We had right. Saga Food Service at Franklin Marshall. And you're tired, you're beat, everybody's gotten all the good stuff, you know, and you're coming in, and you're at that point, you're asking yourself, is this really worth it?
Right.
What makes it worth it?
Well, you know, that's why I love going back into those times, because I love pulling out the mundane, the ridiculous, because out of those experiences, you know, very meaningful things can come. But I think it only can come after time goes by. You know, I think I was aware enough at the time to sort of collect experiences, collect these characters I was with, collect these stories. And perhaps I knew at some point down the road, I could formulate these into stories somehow. And I think that's what made it worth it, is that almost that mindset that we were living this story. And it was, and that's why it was, you know, you're playing Division I, this and that, and again, a beautiful experience. But at the core, sometimes you just wanted to make dinner. You just wanted to get there. So that's why it makes it such a great mix of a rich topic always.
One of the things that I love about it too, Scott, is that because you're a spring sport, yes, you're out there practicing and working like crazy in the fall for a season that doesn't roll around until spring. So even if you play games, they're those meaningless, you know, fall season games.
Absolutely. And that's one of the other sort of moments of awakening, that the fall was probably the most important season of them all. That was the time we had the most time to practice, to really show our stuff, to practice every day. You know, that's where they get to see what they had to work with. It was probably the best weather we were going to see the entire year, right? We wouldn't get anywhere close to September weather until the last weekend of May, or the last weekend of the season, which was May. So it was year long, and that's why you're living with these people every day for the entire year. You don't just show up day one, opening day in spring. You have to find a way to live with a lot of different people, and certainly the characters of coaches interplay with all this as well.
At any level, everybody on the team is competing for a spot. When you get to Division I, though, there are a lot of people dreaming about what happens next. I've talked a lot about this with Maine men's and women's hockey players. How much does a coach like the coach you had and people's thoughts about where they could go collide in a way that sort of throws people off their game? I mean, you think maybe I'm going to be able to make it, and then coach is like, "You ain't going to even play here, you bum." You know, how does that sort of work? I was a Division III guy,
right? You know, it's interesting. Some players probably responded better to, you know, getting their tail kicked a little bit. Some not so much. We pretty much were all treated the same, no matter, you know, where our futures would go. I think. Didn't have maybe we had a couple certainly had a few guys who were drafted and went on to bigger and better things outside of college, and sometimes it was just based on, you know, what position that the coach had to focus on the most. I reference in my story my best friend at the time, or became my best friend, one of my best friends, had it tougher than I did, because he had to take over for the all region. He's actually Lou Marloni, and you know the name.
Yeah, Lou Marloni.
So he had to step in for Lou Marloni after two, you know, player of the year runs and conference championships. And I got to kind of slip in there at second base and kind of bide my time and slide in when it was an opportunity. So, but overall, you know, it's just finding a way to again, kind of lean on each other when the enemy is, and that's what a good coach could also do, right? Kind of funnel all the energy into one enemy, into one person. And so we kind of had our brotherhood with that kind of connection.
We're talking with Scott Palmieri here on Downtown. Well, Scott, I'm a former high school baseball coach, and the title of the piece, Feeds, made me think back. Oh, my God, I know we worked on that. I can still remember drills of middle infielders being in crouches, working on making those perfect tosses to start a double play. But I'm pretty sure I wasn't quite as adamant about perfection as your coach.
And he was a second baseman, so, and I was a second baseman, so there was that kind of that bond and that, and in that fall, I know I became almost twice. My game was defense, and he made me twice the defender I was, you know, repetition. And that's the thing, I say the same things, the word over and over in that piece, because that's what it was. It was in that first day, that first hour, we literally took ground balls for one straight hour, and he counted it and kept telling us how close we were to that hour, and it was never close enough. But that's what it was. It was just an amazingly intense level of training that I had never seen before, but it certainly set the foundation for having a successful career.
Well, also, if we take as fact the hardest part of writing is the rewriting, right? The it would seem to me that, at least I feel that that's something I learned from sports, that I'm not going to get it right every time the first time. I'm not going to make 10 foul shots in a row. If I'm lucky, for me, I hit 200 somewhere above the Mendoza line, right? But always right. that idea that the constant practice will make you better. Do you find that has translated to your writing?
Absolutely. And I think perhaps anything that we did in baseball translated to later in life, seeing things as not as difficult as what we went through on those hot September afternoons. Definitely the idea of revision. And the interesting thing about fielding as well is that unlike hitting, there is this level of perfection that you are trying to get to, as opposed to being content with 3 out of 10. If you fielded 3 out of 10 ground balls, you're not going to be there very long. That's kind of picked up in the novel, The Art of Fielding. There's that errorless streak, right, that happens. And so definitely the art of revision. And that's why it takes me a long time to write anything. It's just this block of ice that you keep chipping away at until you finally, as one writer said, you just abandon it, as feeling as if it's not perfect, but it's good enough.
When you look around current baseball fiction and creative nonfiction and the like, do you see as I do that it's getting better? That's more contemplative, more focused on why people love the game than what happens in the game?
I think so. I think in any so many different forms of writing or areas of writing, you see the different kinds of stories on different voices from these experiences. And that's one of the things I try to do in my fiction is, and that Summer Wood Batley that you mentioned, it's just as much about the people who run the stadium and the people whose lives are centered around those kids, those summer boys coming in every May, as it is about the players playing those games. And so that's why it's such, like I said, such a rich field, because there are an endless number of stories that can come out of there if you sort of examine all the corners of the photograph. And that's why what continues to bring me back to it.
Scott, do you find there are better stories at these levels, at the minor league level, at the collegiate level, than for those who have achieved the highest level in their field?
Well, I think, yeah, and I think that's why even the world of college baseball is still, I think, underexplored, because you have so many of these players who have been shaped by baseball their entire lives or whatever sport might be. And yet most of them have an awareness that they're not going to play beyond that. So they're sort of coming to this realization at the age of 22 that everything they've known, and that was like for us, we weren't going to be professional baseball players, but yet, you know, we were grounded in that, but yet we still had baseball as our core. So it's such an interesting sort of tug of those who are on the borderline of, you know, retiring at a young age or falling off because they're just not quite at that highest level. And thinking about the rest of their lives and what they're going to do with it is, again, a very, very rich and, meaningful area to explore.
Is there a sense of urgency among those guys who realize this game that I've loved, that I've played my whole life, this is it, this is my last chance, and not only do I want to revel in all of it, but I want to walk out knowing that when I got done, I was playing the very best that I could?
Definitely. Yeah. And I think some deal with it better than others. I think, you know, some have that, that dream that, you know, they won't exhaust until every, possibility is drained. But each individual kind of comes to their own piece with that. I feel as if almost every former ball player has the same dream where, there's a game about to happen. They're about to enter it. It's about to start and they're very excited. And then it never happens. They're always kind of that, there's always that missing piece to it. And I had it for years, actually, until I started playing old man's baseball again. And I stopped having that dream because that this part of me was kind of satisfied again, getting back into the physical nature of baseball.
You mentioned the characters in your fiction and how that they're more important than just the fact that it's baseball fiction. Which is so true of the woman who works for that team forever and all the people that are around. What I found really compelling, and I think you even feel it in feeds, is your understanding of what a ball team means to a community. I mean, I lived in upstate New York in Skinny Atlas, and there were all those Nipen ball teams and other teams up there, and people went out to see them. And they went out to see him because they couldn't go to Yankee Stadium or they couldn't get to Cleveland. They didn't get to the big ballparks. And they loved it. And that whole Billet family thing of people taking in the players and generations of it means a lot to a small town. And I think your fiction is keeping that alive for people that don't know that.
I agree. And there was Will Gagan, right? Bruce, I know you know Summer Baseball Nation highlighted that as a reporter, telling those stories of these summer leagues across the country. We have one right down the street now in our town here, Wakefield, Rhode Island, and people come out, right? The kids come out, the families come out, the families keep the players up. And this whole, world of baseball that's sort of still quietly going on, beyond the outside of the fanfare, outside of all the big headlines and the angst about baseball, perhaps fading from the popular mindset. And yet these leagues are still strong, even if for players who won't, again, you won't see them again. You won't see them on ESPN. But there's something that's still binding communities through baseball, which is really, for a baseball lover, of course, it's beautiful to see.
I love independent league baseball. If we still had a team here, I would go. We just don't, unfortunately.
Maybe someday.
Well, it'd be nice to have it come back. Scott, it's always a pleasure to see you. Always a pleasure to talk to you. I hope we'll see you in New Brunswick next year for SLA. If we do, stop by here that Wednesday, and we'll see you live on the air.
That would be terrific. Bruce, thank you so much. Rich, thank you so much.
Thank you. Scott Palmieri with us here on Downtown on Sports Lit 101. It's 4:49. We'll take a break. Be back in just a moment on Z62.
Hi, this is Liz Bassey, and you're listening to Downtown with Richard Kimball.
When today is unpredictable, you need sound advice and strong support to help you stay focused on your long-term financial goals.